very difficult to accuse someone of fraud. One of the things that con men often do is to look straight in your face and say, are you calling me a liar? And in those situations, the correct thing to say is, yes, I am.
That's Dan Davies, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back, one and all, to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. Who am I? I'm a risk professional. I'm many other things, including a husband, an endurance athlete, a martial artist. And for the next hour plus, I'm your host on the All Things Risk podcast. The All Things Risk podcast is a show about risk and uncertainty in just about anything. And that's because it's my belief that risk and uncertainty are things we should all understand better. And that's exactly what we try to do here via informative and interesting conversations. But before we get into it, this episode is brought to you by Audible, the home for audiobooks. And for my listeners, for listeners of the All Things Risk podcast, you can get a 30-day free trial plus a free audiobook, which is yours to keep. To do that, just go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk. That's if you live in the USA. Or click on the link accompanying this post if you are based in the UK like me. You can choose from over 180,000 titles and get yourself an audiobook for the device of your choice. Okay, today we talk fraud. And if we think about some of recent history's most prominent frauds, from, say, the Bernie Madoff scandal, the LIBOR scandal in the banking world, the Enron scandal, and just about really every fraud in history, they have a number of complexities to them. However, as you will hear from my guest, all frauds follow a simple logic, and that logic is based on trust. My guest today is Dan Davies. Dan is a former Bank of England economist. He has worked for a variety of investment banks, and he has always had a fascination with those huge, larger-than-life financial scandals like the collapse of Baring Brothers that was precipitated by rogue trader Nick Leeson and was, of course, subject of the film Rogue Trader featuring Ewan McGregor. The Nazi gold scandal was another one at the Swiss banks and many more. So much so that he recently wrote an enthralling book called Lying for Money: How Legendary Frauds Reveal the Workings of Our World. It's a very readable book that gives you just about everything you want and need to know about fraud. Nassim Taleb of Black Swan fame says that if you want to learn to fend fraud, read this book. And if you want to commit fraud, don't. But if you absolutely must, read this first. It's a fascinating book, and we talk about it and we get into all of that in this episode, in which we cover a concept called the optimal level of fraud in an economy. And that sounds weird, but as you'll hear, in just about any advanced economy, there will always be a level of fraud because there will always be a level and must be a level of trust. So we talk about that. We get into the types and characteristics of frauds around the world and throughout history, the mechanics of these types of frauds, loads and loads of examples. We talk about rogue traders. We get into how individuals and organizations can protect themselves against frauds, why frauds all seem to have, or many seem to have, this type of snowball effect in which the perpetrators find themselves in a fraud, in an operation that gets itself out of hand. We get into the role of primal human emotions in fraud and tons more. I think you're going to find this fascinating. So, ladies and gentlemen, here's Dan Davies. It's a pleasure to have you on. We're going to have a wonderful conversation about fraud and your book, Lying for Money, and I am really looking forward to it.
Great. Thanks very much for inviting me, Ben.
So I wanted to first start by getting to know a little bit of your background and trying to understand what got you interested in economics and fraud and eventually writing this book. So it might be useful for my listeners to give them a little bit of what you've done throughout your career and all of that, and we can lead up into how this led to this recent book.
Sure. Well, kind of fraud kept on sort of seeking me out, as it were. I started my career at the Bank of England, where I worked in a department called regulatory policy, which was just made up of odds and ends of things that the Bank of England thought it should be taking an interest in, but didn't necessarily have much power over it, which is why they called it policy. And, I mean, among other sort of odd things I had to do there was look into the prepaid funerals industry in order to decide whether that was regulated deposit-taking business. But while I was there, the Barings crisis happened, or as very arch people at the Bank of England call it, the second Barings crisis, because there was another one at the end of the 19th century. And they were in the division just down the corridor from us. And I just saw people going in and out of what was previously a very sort of sleepy, looked after itself, medium-sized UK merchant banking supervision division, getting more and more anxious. And then it hit the news. And yeah, it's never, as you be aware, it's never a great feeling when your employer is on the evening news. It's unusual for that to be for a good reason. And that was my first experience to a kind of really big corporate fraud. I then went on to become a stock analyst at a variety of brokerages, some but not all of which still exist. And I was covering the banking industry, and in particular the global investment banking industry. And there's always a little bit of a whiff of sulfur to that industry. There's always shady things going on. So I was covering the Swiss banks over the Nazi gold scandal, or what they euphemistically termed the dormant accounts scandal. You know, that being the accounts effectively of Jewish people in Nazi Germany, where the accounts went dormant between 1934 and 1945, and the Swiss banks pretended that they didn't know exactly why and just let those assets sit there and kept on trying to take ownership of them themselves. And that blew up into a massive issue for them, basically because a security guard started reading some of the paperwork he was being asked to shred and blew the whistle on the whole thing. And that's the, you know, that's the sort of thing that goes on in the global banking industry. And it went on. And then, obviously, between 2008 and 2012, working, covering the investment banking industry, you get a ringside seat at some of, quite literally, the biggest commercial frauds ever to have taken place. And so I retired from that job in 2014 and managed to get in contact with a very good publisher at Profile Books. And they said, you know, what sort of thing would you like to write? And I thought, I've always thought that someone should make a systematic study of corporate frauds and look at the things that they've got in common and see if that tells us anything interesting about anything. And that's what the book's all about.
And it's a very fascinating book. It's very readable. And you do a wonderful job of breaking down the different types of frauds, and there's some really colorful stories in there. I wanted to maybe start this concept of fraud, of talking about some of the origins or some of the factors of fraud. And you talk about a fraud triangle, I think is what you call it at the end of your book. And one of the themes that also comes across throughout the book, and we can get into the different types of frauds out there, but it's this thing about trust that we need. You know, fraudsters need trust to be able to carry out their frauds. And the other term that you use is around it's an equilibrium quantity. Maybe if you could just break this down, why is trust so important in terms of fraud?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the thing that's kind of interesting is it's trust and time are the absolute essence of the crime of fraud. I think it's J.K. Galbraith, the economist, first noticed that fraud is unusual because it's got a time dimension. There's actually a period of time when the criminal knows that they've stolen the money, but the victim doesn't yet know that they've lost it. And it happens because you can't check up on everything. In a very simple economics textbook, there's no time dimension. All the transactions happen at the same time. Production might sort of take place over time, but it's not a time that really matters for anything. You might as well have everything happening absolutely simultaneously. In the real world, cash flows come in and out at different times. And so there's always going to be a question of who is it that gets paid up front and who is it that has to wait to get paid until the goods have been sold to a final consumer who's got some spare money. And that pattern of who gets paid and up front and who has to wait is what tells you about who trusts who and who has to trust who, because it's also a question about how buyer and supplier power in the industry is distributed. And of course, any time where you've got a situation where there's a payment that you are expecting to be made, but which is fundamentally out of your control, you've really got two choices of what you're going to do about that. And your choices are checking or trusting. And trusting makes you vulnerable to fraud, but checking costs money. So effectively, by the amount of money you invest in the audit process, you're almost investing in insurance against someone committing a crime against you. But it's a very odd type of insurance because you've got absolutely no idea what the risk you're covering is, and you've only got a fairly vague idea of what sort of premium you're paying. In general, the more you can do by trusting, the cheaper and more efficient the economy is. That's why high-trust societies are places like Canada and Sweden, and low-trust societies are places like Nigeria and Greece.
This reminds, when you talk about this, this reminds me of, you talk about the Canadian paradox. I was reminded of a bit of work I did several years ago, and that was for a company that was about to make a big investment in Nigeria. And we had a workshop, and one of the speakers at the workshop talked about corruption in Nigeria. And of course, there's a huge amount of it in a country like that. But then they talked about the kind of the village societies in Nigeria, so local communities and villages. And there's a bit of a paradox that is different in a society like Nigeria, where you can, if you're at the top of the pyramid, you can kind of get away, and actors have gotten away with massive frauds and massive corruption. Yeah. But in a local village, you could get killed for so much as stealing a pig.
Yeah, absolutely. Or actually, the one thing that's kind of was suggested to me after the book was published was by Taleb, who was saying that, look at the business networks of Lebanese traders.
Mm-hmm.
The business networks of Lebanese traders probably show how far you can push and the absolute limits of how far you can push a system that is purely based on personal trust. Because Lebanese importers and exporters the world over do business based on family ties and personal connections, in many cases going back further into history than you can possibly imagine. And it works for them, but it's worth noting that the global networks of the Lebanese traders all over Africa and the Americas is the only example of one of those family-based networks that there are. It's very difficult to run an economy on that basis. And you can't grow that way. You can't really kind of set out and pioneer a new country like the United States of America or Canada on that basis. And so in Canada, it's the exact opposite of what you had in the Nigerian system. It's very democratic. Anyone who likes in Canada, if they've got a decent education and one good suit, they can probably end up with a fraudulent mining stock promotion and steal a few million dollars. You know, eventually they might end up getting caught by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. But the reason it works is that most people don't do it. And part of the state of affairs that makes it possible to get away with so many scams in Canada, and particularly its regional stock exchanges, some of which are just appalling, is that it's possible to start up a legitimate business in Canada. And actually, starting up and running a legitimate business for most people is a more obvious thing to do than starting up a fraud. So you have places like Greece where it's quite difficult, unless you're in the government, to commit a crime of dishonesty because no one will do business with you. But it's also incredibly difficult to start up a new company because no one will do business with you.
Mm-hmm. And if you're that fraudulent Canadian mining company owner, you can get away with it. You can restart. However, if you're that Lebanese trader, the local villager, or the Greek merchant, if you commit a fraud and you're found guilty of it, everything goes away.
Absolutely. You're out of all your business networks. You're out of your social networks. You're probably even out of your family.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the different types of frauds that you very colorfully and very well articulated in the book? So you start with, you explain the sort of four types. There's this thing called the long firm, there's counterfeiting, there's control fraud, and there's market crime. I think it'd be useful for my listeners to maybe step through each of these, maybe starting with this concept of the long firm fraud.
Sure. I mean, the idea here is that there's four steps here, and each one of them is a step up in the level of sophistication of the economic institution that it's exploiting. So a long firm, which is the older kind of Anglo-Saxon word for it, is simply stealing by lying. It's a case where you either obtain valuable goods on the basis of a promise to pay, or you obtain money on the basis of either a loan or a promise to deliver valuable goods, and then you use the time between you getting the value and having to make the payment to generate cash and disappear. So, you know, it's as simple as that. It's like buying a load of consumer electronics on 30-day credits, then selling them all down at a market stall and running away with the cash. So it's not that sophisticated. You have to reach a certain amount of stage of development in an economy before it's possible to run that con, but it's not that much of a stage of development. Obviously, when people start trying to deal with the fact that it's very easy to steal by lying, they start by bringing in certification mechanisms. So you start getting requirements for audited accounts, you start getting notarized documents, you start getting certificate that a banker's draft is valuable, and an attack on the certification system is a counterfeit. Mm-hmm. So the most obvious thing to counterfeit is cash, but you can also counterfeit safety certificates. You know, if you are an extremely amoral person, you can counterfeit pharmaceuticals and sort of operate that way. But in all these cases, what you've got is a whole infrastructure like the accountancy profession or the legal notaries, even the medical profession, which has a set of institutions that are really set up to economize on information. They're set up to certify things so that not everyone has to check them out for brand new every time they do some business. So when you introduce gold dust into a bag of rock and send it off to be assayed, that's a counterfeit because it's an attack on a certification system.
Mm-hmm.
As you start moving up the ladder of sophistication and economic developments, you get the divergence between ownership and control. And a control fraud is a kind of crime of dishonesty, usually involving either a counterfeit or a long firm or some other way of stealing money. But a control fraud is where you're actually trying to steal money by transferring it yourself through basically legitimate means, but by doing so by assets that you're controlling dishonestly because you're controlling them for your own benefit rather than under the terms of whoever agreed to give you control of them. So the classic way to do this is the old savings and loan fraud. And the phrase control fraud was actually coined by a bank regulator to describe what crooked SNLs did, which is that if you want to rob a bank, the best way is to get control of a small savings bank, set things up so that in the natural course of business, that savings bank will pay out a percentage of its value to you, either by dividends or by senior management bonuses or by buying assets from another company that you own at market or above market valuations. And then once you've got that thing which you control and which pays out a percentage of its value to you, you just inflate it to multiples of its former size with borrowed money. This is actually very difficult to detect because none of the individual transactions are crooked. You know, it's perfectly legal for a company to grow. It's legal for a company to borrow money. And when a company pays out a dividend, it's not like a long firm. It's not an intrinsically fraudulent transaction. That's why they're so difficult to bust, because the only evidence that this thing is actually a fraud rather than an ambitious business that had a bit of bad luck is inside the head of the controlling mind. And we actually kind of cover some examples in the book where it's not obvious that there even is a controlling mind, because you can quite easily, and my view is that a lot of banks did between 2000 and 2008, set up a system of incentives that will have all the effects of doing things that a control fraud would do, but there's no one individual who plants them that way. It's what they call a criminogenic system, which is a system of business incentives which is, encourages people to commit criminal acts. And then towards the end of the book, we have just the highest level of abstraction, which is for things which arguably aren't even really crimes, because you can get to a point in the economic development of society where it has economic and market entities that are so big and so important that their internal rules start getting the status of crimes. For example, insider dealing. You know, for most of the forms of fraud, you can find a commandment in the Ten Commandments that tells you not to do this. So, like, long firm is just thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness could reasonably be glossed as saying that you shouldn't forge qualifications or banknotes or draft letters. But there's nothing in the Ten Commandments that's going to say thou shalt not trade securities while in possession of material inside information. You know, and that wasn't even a crime anywhere in the world until the 1930s, when it was made a crime in the USA. It was made a crime in the UK in the 1980s. It was banned in New Zealand for civil tort in 1998, but only made a criminal matter in 2005. Now, for most of the lifespan of securities markets, it's just been thought that having inside information is what smart people do, and it's okay to be an insider dealer. Yeah, similarly with the law on cartels. For most of the history of trade and of business, the intuition has been that guilds are perfectly legitimate things to exist, and that someone who is undercutting his competitors by selling at a lower price than them, he's the one doing the dishonest thing, and there should be legislation passed to make sure that every baker in town sells bread at exactly the same price. It's only comparatively late, and again, first in the USA, and only later in most other places, that people start saying that cartels are a conspiracy against the public interest, and the public has a right to create, out of absolutely nothing, a crime which, when you look at it, must have looked at the time like a ban on freedom of expression and freedom of association.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's the famous quote from Adam Smith, which is used as the basis for kind of competition law and antitrust law, where he says men of the same business never meet together, even for idle merriment, without some kind of conspiracy against the public good. And that's the bit that everyone quotes. But the very next sentence is Smith saying, however, there is nothing that can be done about this, because to pass any law against it would be absurdly illiberal and probably counterproductive. That's how people thought right into, you know, well past the end of the 19th century. And so the market crime is something that you look at it and you think, is this really a crime, or is this a rule of organisation of the economy that has gained the status of a crime because some things in the economy are so big and so important that their internal rules actually kind of reach the status of criminal sanctions?
There's a lot there. One of the things that I perhaps wanted to add in here was when you describe the long-term fraud, you also talk about Silk Road. And so you talk about stages of development, but this is a multi-layered thing, because as new technologies enter the fray, then this cycle seems to perhaps repeat itself as we go through the development cycles of those new forms of technology.
It's absolutely beautiful, isn't it? This and Bitcoin as well. All of these guys are inventing a brand. You know, the way that you can tell, in many ways, that they really are inventing a brand new economy and a brand new sort of system, is that when they're doing that, they're reinventing all of the same mistakes that we originally made in the real economy. So Silk Road, for your listeners, was an online market where you could buy drugs. And it had a whole load of technological protection against fraud. It was absolutely the case that you were meant to put your money into escrow with their central Silk Road organization, put your bitcoins into escrow, as it were, and then wait till your drugs were delivered and then certify that they'd been delivered so that the money would be then released to the vendor. And all of the technological stuff worked, and all of the social and economic stuff just didn't work for them at all, because this was one of the things we wanted to talk about. Fraud's an equilibrium condition. The amount of money and time that people are prepared to waste on fraud prevention depends on the benefits that they get from doing so. And so while it was possible to use the escrow system and be absolutely 100% fraud proof, it was kind of a pain in the ass to do so. And also, most of the merchants were honest. And so most of the time, if you said, I'll just send you the Bitcoin, we won't bother with the delay and the small fee for using the escrow service, send me the drugs, you've got an honest face. Most of the time that worked. And so everyone got into the habit of doing it. And then because everyone got into the habit of not using the escrow system, you got lots of people who started using it to commit. Well, I mean, you know, I don't like my book being used as an instruction manual, but I think all of your listeners have got the wit to realize that if people are sending you untraceable Bitcoin money in exchange for a promise that you will send them illegal drugs, there's quite an easy way to defraud those people.
Yeah, the incentives are there.
But yeah, you know, just by not sending the drugs, which is not something you want to do if you want to maintain your reputation. Yeah. And reputations were really important on the Silk Road market. They had a feedback system modeled on eBay, which people used a lot. But of course, the thing about being a drug dealer is that it's not really a lifetime career.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you want to hand out to your children.
Yeah.
And so when people decided, I'm leaving university now, I'm growing up, getting a family, I don't want to do the online drug dealing anymore, there was a huge incentive to just build up a load of orders and then disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, it's classic long firm. It's something that you could drop the trade twins in, and it would not take them long at all to work out what was going on and how they could do it for themselves.
Right, and it's it comes back to trust again. So do a few transactions and build up that trust. It's the same thing that you, I suppose, we see in classic bait and switch type of frauds, where you create some form of legitimacy and again build up that trust. A transaction comes in, and then you switch the client into something dodgier where you can collect commissions or whatever it is that you're trying to do.
Absolutely. Or the same name scam, the New England Mafia were fond of, which is just simply you start up a company that's got a really similar name to an existing company. And then you start just basically telling people all around the place that this company's name is slightly changed and they should send checks to Acme Manufacturing and Trading Inc. rather than Acme Trading Inc. and steal the payments that way. And the reason it keeps on popping up is that there's a clear equilibrium here, because trust is a really valuable technology. Mm-hmm. So much of any system, so much of any risk management system is based on costly checking, and trust really helps you economize on all of that cost and all of that expense. The more you can trust, the less money you're spending on what is basically, from the point of view of the whole economy,
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And doing business just on the basis of simply contracts, you could never do it that way. If you always have to default to what's in the contract, what the fine print says in the contract, then everything slows to a crawl and nothing happens. And I think it was it Stephen, one of these motivational speaker types, Stephen Covey, was it, who said, business at the speed of trust or something like this. But it's true that trust lubricates, makes everything go smoother, quick, everything's quicker, more efficient. But there's a flip side, obviously, to that.
Yeah, which is your losses through fraud. But the interesting thing is that the optimum level of fraud could be very high. If you look at all of the really sort of productive eras, like if you look at the Industrial Revolution, the Gold Rush, the dot-com boom, there was a lot of fraud in all of these periods. Something like 1 in 6 of all companies floated on the London Stock Exchange between 1830 and 1860 were frauds.
Right.
On the other hand, between 1830 and 1860, that was the absolute high period of British industrialization and Victorian England. But there were huge numbers of dot-com companies that were either frauds or something so close to frauds as makes no difference. But the internet did get invented during that period. A lot of the time, you start asking, do you want to make sure you're completely safe from fraud losses, or do you want to be rich? Investors don't always want to be protected. They want to invest.
Right. And it's the classic risk-return calculus, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah. The trouble being that in the book I kind of talk about there's two types of fraud. You've got your classic Donald Cressy triangle fraud, where you just have, it's like means, motive, and opportunity for a murder. You have someone with a need, which takes the place of a motive, is the need for more cash than they can generate honestly. They have an opportunity, which is a defective control of some sort. And then the third leg of the fraud triangle is rationalization. You've got someone has to break down the psychological barriers that we all normal people have against lying, which most people really are set up to be very, very reluctant to tell important lies about money. It's practically a cultural universal. And that triangle model lets you think about the trade-offs. It lets you explain why Canada has a load of securities fraud and is really rich. Greece has hardly any, but is not so poor. Because Canada, I'm sorry, I'm not picking on Canada specifically.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's in the book.
Yes, it's absolutely.
It's a rich and egalitarian economy. So it creates fewer of the type of people who have need and rationalization, so it can afford to offer lots of opportunities. And, you know, the way that Canadian regional securities regulation is set up offers lots and lots of opportunities. Greece and, you know, those Nigerian and Lebanese trust networks that we were talking to know that they've got lots of people who are going to be in a situation where they feel the need to generate that cash, and the temptation's always going to be there. So they organize themselves to minimize the set of opportunities. And that's the way you can think about the trade-offs.
Mm.
But then there's always that little kind of, or in many cases, often very large, there's that tail of the distribution that works outside the world of the trade-offs that you can make and manage, because fraudsters who think big will design their frauds around the controls that you've introduced. So I'm just writing another few chapters for the American edition about the various forms of check fraud and financial fraud in the USA specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And I find I keep on writing footnotes saying, you can't get away with this fraud anymore because they changed the controls, or you can't get away with this anymore because they introduced automatic detection systems. And what I'm now worrying is that I keep saying this and someone's going to start thinking, well, this is basically a progressive view of history. One by one, the loopholes get plugged up and we're moving towards a more honest society because the controls are improving. But then you think, well, you know, in the last few years, we had LIBOR.
Yes.
We had the tax-related scandal. We had the near
subprime,
collapse of the whole global economy.
Subprime mortgages.
And so what actually happens is that you plug the leaks as they show up, but then there's an overstructure, and someone or some kind of distributed group of people who are able to understand those controls can work around them. And that's the really dangerous situation, because a fraud that's got around those controls, because it can't be detected, there's not much check on its ability to grow.
Right. So the when things go bust, when things blow up, to coin a phrase that Nassim Taleb likes to use, it just gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it gets bigger and bigger until the effect of compound interest brings it to a point at which someone in the system gets a demand for a payment that they can't cover, no matter how hard they cook them up, and it all falls apart. And in general, my view is that that is how frauds fall apart, because once you have opened up two sets of books, as it were, there's a gap between the honest books and the public books. Because that gap is related to a business enterprise which would be expected to grow, the gap itself is subject to compound growth. You know, and any more cash that the fraudster takes out fraud will expand that gap, and that new gap will also be subject to compound growth. And that's why frauds snowball. If you look at Bernard Madoff, for example, in order to steal, as in transfer formally, fraudulently to himself, a sum of money which could not have been in nine digits, it must have been in tens rather than hundreds of millions, he had to create tens of billions of fictitious and fraudulent assets. And there was a huge argument in the end between the Madoff liquidators and the Madoff investors about whether compensation or kind of claims on the bankruptcy estate of the Madoff funds should be based on the amount of money people put in for the amount of money they thought they had. You know, which was particularly embarrassing for some of them, because some of the early Madoff investors had actually, if you look at it in just in cash terms, over the years, taken out more money than they'd put in. And, you know, obviously, they, in paper, they believe they lost $100 million, but the liquidator was saying, well, you put in $5 million and you took $10 million out. By rights, we should be asking you for money.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. What's your view? The couple of things we could talk about. One of those that when you talk about the Enron case in the book, and the snowball effect is very interesting. And as you read it, I almost not that you quite feel sorry for some of these characters, but you can kind of sense the desperation as they try and cover their tracks, and looking for that exit strategy becomes paramount, of paramount importance. And you sort of think to yourself, why would you try and pull anything like that off? And what's interesting is you talk about this thing, this sort of slippery slope, that maybe they never intended to be in that position, but they found themselves in that position. That's fascinating to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, have you read Bethany McLean's Smartest Guys in the Room?
Yes, yes.
The chapters towards the end of that where Jeff Skilling has just basically destroyed his life.
Yes.
It's really quite harrowing. You know, he's gone from sort of being the kind of captain of industry. He's still, everyone's beginning to suspect something. He knows that the game's over, and he just goes AWOL. There's 2 weeks where no one can find him for business meetings, and he's just sitting in bars in downtown Houston sipping white wine and getting the nickname Silent Jeff. And the thing is that, in general, you start doing these things because temporarily you've got a gap to cover. You've got a smallish loss in the 5/8 account, or if you're Nick Leeson, and you think that this is a temporary move, and that something good will come along in a month or so, like some trading gains or like a sort of business venture, the contract on the Indian power plant in the case of Enron, and there will be enough cash to cover the little bit of an exaggeration that you put in, and everything will be back to normal and nobody will notice. You know, a lot of the time this probably happens.
Yes.
Because, you know, if it did work out that way, then we wouldn't notice.
Yes.
And even if someone at eagle-eyed controller did notice, 9 times out of 10, they would do exactly the wrong thing, which is to say, oh, that was a bit dodgy, don't do it again, rather than escalating it. But then when that doesn't happen, you've got a much bigger hole, which means you need to take a much bigger gamble, because taking a small gamble, it isn't going to do anything. And then once you're 5 or 6 gambles deep, that must be a very strange psychological place to be in, because you still, at that point, must know that nothing is going to make this thing right. But you can't kind of pull the plaster off quickly. You kind of feel like you've got to play out the hand until its end, and just keep on expanding it until something happens. Now, there really seems to be, in a lot of these cases, a psychological sense, once the losses have got out of control, that they suddenly cut down the connection between what's going on and them. And I think that is linked to the rationalization that allowed them to commit the fraud in the first place. Time and time again, I had to read several dozen autobiographies of fraudsters in the research for this book. And it is an experience I absolutely would not recommend to anyone. I've got a bibliography in the back of the book with notes about which ones of them were particularly horrible. But for all of them, there's reasons why it's never their fault. Mm. It's always the fault of someone who made unreasonable demands on them, or someone who could and should have stopped them. They have a way of distancing themselves from their own actions. And I think that in the later stage, that psychological mechanism of distancing yourself from the action turns into absolute full-on flat-out denial, and then that's how they start just refusing to look at the accounts or keeping themselves out of the office, because they no longer want to believe that this is something that's under their control.
So fascinating. One of my favorite lines of your book is when you talk about Nick Leeson and how he destroyed destroyed a 200-year banking dynasty because he didn't want to say sorry.
Yeah. The interesting thing, though, about Leeson is that, and I, as I say, when I was at the Bank of England, shortly after Barings had collapsed, one of the odd little jobs my division got to do was to look at how you might have an inquiry into stopping this sort of thing happening again. And there were obvious things like not having the head of trading also being the head of back office.
Yeah, no, that wasn't a good move.
Yeah. But when we started looking into the psychology of rogue traders and whether they could be identified, there were two kind of horrible things that we discovered, and which they're now out in the academic literature. There definitely is a personality type that is common to rogue traders. They tend to be outsiders. They tend to be driven people with something to prove. They tend to have fragile egos and to react badly to failure. And they tend to be workaholics. And you can, you know, you can have this tick, and, you know, Jerome Kerviel, Clifford Adeboli, Joe Jett at Kidder Peabody Hammer many years ago, the guy at Daiwa, Mr. Copper, who sort of lost a huge amount in the copper futures market, all of them, not quite the right school, always felt they had something to prove. The thing is, though, that if you take that psychological profile, it's also true of successful traders.
Right.
It's all of the psychological characteristics of the guys who go bad are also true of some of the best traders that there are out there in financial markets. And so it's for that reason, it's basically useless as a template for people recruiting and trying to avoid hiring a load of fraudsters.
Right. Because, yeah, absolutely. Have you read The Hour Between Dog and Wolf?
Great book.
Yeah, yeah. The psychology of it and the neuroscience, it makes a lot of sense. But you're right, and you could argue, I think Taleb makes the same sort of argument around those that are successful and not successful. It's you've just got the same pool of people. Some are lucky and some aren't.
I ended up thinking after I read that book, Owl Between Dog and Wolf, is that every bank supervisor should be made to have a spread betting account for six, because just to have the experience of gambling with their own money with too much leverage. Because you get people in bank supervision, in regulation, who will talk about margin calls in a very abstract academic way. And it's my strong belief that you don't understand that at all until you've had the physical sensation, and it is a genuine physical sensation of experiencing a margin call when you, which is hard for you to pay.
Right. Yes.
Physical, hormonal. It's exactly the sort of things that Owl Between Dog and Wolf talked about.
Right. Yes. That's right. It's physical as well as mental as rational. Absolutely. One of the things as well that you mentioned when you talk about control frauds and you talk about Enron, and a lot of the indicators were already there. I think Malcolm Gladwell wrote a thing about Enron and he called it open secrets.
Yeah.
So if you actually did it's just a question of efficiency. You don't have the time to do a forensic analysis of the books, but the indicators were there.
Yeah. Do you know what, Ben? I think we're letting ourselves off a little bit too easy in saying that it's about efficiency.
Okay.
As well, you're being nice about this with Enron, because Enron I can't blame on anyone else. But the UK PPI scandal.
Right.
I was covering that for ABN AMRO and later for Panmure Gordon, two stock brokerages that don't exist anymore. It was absolutely my job to know whether that was a massive fraud. I knew lots and lots of details of what was going on in that market, and I never wrote a darn thing about it being a fraud.
Right. My North American listeners, would you be able to give them a quick synopsis of what the PPI scandal was all about?
Sure. Payment protection insurance, basically privatized unemployment insurance. It would, in principle, pay back your loan if you lost your job. In principle, it was not a bad product. In practice, it was overpriced by a factor of about 4 or 5. It was sold in a completely fraudulent way, which underestimated its costs. And it was sold to lots of people who were self-employed and couldn't even possibly make a claim on it. And the extent to which it protected you against losing your job because of illness was also generally systematically lied about. In the end, I think I stopped counting when the compensation payments the UK banks had to make went above 20 billion sterling, but that was 3 or 4 years ago, and they've still been growing since then. So I wouldn't be surprised if it ended up being the equivalent of 50 billion US that they ended up paying out. So it's one of the biggest frauds in the history of British banking, albeit that after LIBOR and subprime, there's a bit of a drop off. And it was my job to spot that, and I didn't, despite the fact that I knew all of the facts that would have allowed me to do so. Mm-hmm. So it certainly wasn't a problem of efficiency or time and effort there. I have a whole file on this because I was really angry about a technical point of insurance accounting that I thought wasn't being done properly. I didn't think it was a fraud because it's very difficult to accuse someone of fraud. One of the things that con men often do is to look straight in your face and say, "Are you calling me a liar?"
Hmm.
And in those situations, the correct thing to say is, "Yes, I am, because of this evidence I have, which suggests you're lying." But it's very difficult to make yourself do that. You know, it's like starting a fight. It's an aggressive act.
Mm-hmm.
And to initiate that kind of aggression, we're back to all of the kind of real sort of lizard brain dog and wolf things here. To initiate an aggressive act against someone who is a chief executive officer and who, you know, we're talking about people like Sir Fred Goodwin here, who is one of the most admired chief executive officers of the period between 2000 and 2008. And the least admired shortly after that. It would have been a hard thing to do. And so I can only assume that there was just a little department of my subconscious mind that was trying to stop me from doing something which would necessarily have involved starting a fight with someone much, you know, bigger and stronger than me. I don't think it's about necessarily all about efficiency and checking up. There's a lot of...
There's a primal part to all of this, isn't there?
It's either primal or it's very deep in socialization that it's difficult to accuse things of fraud, people of fraud, in a high-trust society. You know, maybe in somewhere like, I hate to pick on Greece because I love the country, but maybe in one of the Greek islands, it's really easy to accuse someone of tricking you. But in UK or USA or Canada or some high-trust economies, one of the features of high-trust economies is that they're economies where there's a big stigma against lying, and that means it's very difficult to accuse someone effectively of lying, which is what you have to do if fraud detection is what you're aiming to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And there's also that piece around whether or not it's Sir Fred Goodwin or whoever. You think, well, they wouldn't have got there unless, you know, they were ethical, upstanding, smart, you know, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of the time, things which look, a lot of the time, accusations of fraud turn out to be not quite right. Mm. And in that case, you know, what do you look like for having sort of cried wolf? There's also every... In many ways, you could almost say, if you were trying to be provocative or sort of for your student debating society, the institutions of business in high-trust economies are set up to make it as difficult as possible to detect and accuse frauds.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, with that thought in mind, I was wondering about what you think some of the ways in which either individuals or organizations, what they can do to minimize fraud. And I know you talk about this, the benefits of thinking like a fraudster. So maybe that's a good place to take this.
Well, I think there's two levels of fraud. Mm-hmm. You know, if you kind of think about how you manage something, and if you actually really kind of think about your processes and how you measure performance and what you look at, then you're pretty far along the way to looking at what are the things that someone who's trying to defraud or subvert your systems is going to look at. Because in many ways, I think, as I say, because I think there's two kind levels of fraud, I think there's two levels of fraud prevention. You have your everyday kind of opportunistic fraud, your kind of Cressy's fraud, triangle fraud, where just one day there's dishonest people out there. Every day you bump into them like you bump into germs. If you have good controls and a strong immune system, then most of the time when you bump into those guys who've got the rationalization and the need, they will not get the opportunity. And you can choose the trade-off between how many, almost literally how many transactions you're going to do a deep dive on, the cost of doing so versus the expected loss of fraud. As we said, though, against the real kings of fraud, the real fraud entrepreneurs, you're not going to get that chance because they're going to design themselves to get round your immune system. And in that case, as far as I can tell, the only thing that saves you is the snowball property. The one signature that frauds have is rapid growth. So towards the end of the book, you know, where I kind of feel like where I felt like I had to put some actual concrete suggestion in there, I ended up saying the golden rule is that if something is growing unusually quickly, it needs to be checked out, which is the simple property, and it needs to be checked out in a way that it hasn't been checked out before, which is the kind of design property. I think that would have caught most of the frauds in my book, because what you're doing is you're saying anything that's not growing at an exponential rate, there's a limit to how much it can harm me. Something at an exponential rate will at some point grow big enough that it can harm me a lot. If you've got something that you think needs to be checked out as if it was a fraud, there's no point in just pulling the same reports and having a really careful look at them. You know, that's where you have to start getting creative. You have to start kicking the tires, demanding to physically visit the site, demanding to talk to a different employee who isn't responsible for giving you the reports every week. Just doing something different, that's a step that someone who had designed their crime around your normal control system wouldn't have expected you to do.
Right. And that's not necessarily how most organizations set up controls and risk management activities and this sort of thing. Often these things are built to deal with, you know, the most recent crisis, as opposed to something more holistic, the types of things that you're talking about.
Well, indeed, many of them are not really developed as fraud systems. Classic example is Medicare in the 1980s. In the 1980s, credible, as in not particularly political, estimates of the proportion of fraud in the Medicare system was that it was somewhere between 20 and 30%. And that's 20 and 30% of one of the biggest US government programs going. Probably Medicare had the title for the world's biggest fraud until the banks took it back in the year 2000. And that was all because people had presumed that Medicare's big problem was overtreatment, and they had presumed that the big problem was doctors doing defensive medicine because they were worried about being sued. And so all of the Medicare kind of claims management systems were set up to detect unusual cases and excessive treatments. And so they weren't set up to detect little clinics in Florida that submitted 4,000 identical claims for hip replacements, or sort of submitted claims for complicated electric wheelchairs that they never delivered. And it was, there is actually in one of the books in the bibliography a case study of a little health insurer that got everything right. And the way that they got everything right was by realizing that the goal of claims adjustment in their particular field of medical insurance was not to minimize the cost, but it was to pay the correct amount of claims. And so they would spend whatever time and trouble they felt was necessary on each claim to check it out. And they, you know, they would make phone calls. As a result, they were one of the least cost-efficient claims management teams in the entire health insurance industry by the standard metrics of the amount of dollars spent per claim processed. But they were one of the most profitable health insurance companies because if you adjusted the metric to the total amount of money paid out, it turns out that all of that time spent on being inefficient in claims management was incredibly well invested in terms of the amount of money you paid out to fraudulent claims. Mm. And then in the end, obviously, bad actors stopped bothering you. So you didn't even have that much fraudulent claims to deal with.
That's fascinating. Yeah, that's very interesting. I'd like to, I know we probably want to wrap up relatively soon, but I wanted to get your views on if you were concerned about frauds, major frauds now in the world economy, where would you look? And I know we talked about things like Silk Road and Bitcoin, and would that be an area of concern for you?
Well, it depends on what you mean by concern.
Okay.
In the sense that, yeah, there's millions and millions of frauds going on in Bitcoin and
sure.
ICO.
And crypto, yeah. Yeah.
but it doesn't concern me that much.
Right.
All these people are idiots and they deserve to lose their money.
Okay. Right. Yeah,
kind of harsh. I'm sure that there are some widows and orphans in there. But, yeah, you know, as we were saying with Silk Road, all of the fallacies of the mainstream economy are being reinvented one at a time by the Bitcoin guys. Mm. I would be interested to know if anyone is bothering with normal securities fraud these days, because, you know, if you can raise $200 million on an ICO on the basis of a single white paper in a basically unregulated market, I would say you would have to be an absolute idiot to try and do anything fraudulent on a regulated stock exchange.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a lot of that. I mean, I'm going to take an agnostic position on whether Bitcoin itself is a bubble or what it's useful for. But, you know, lots of these ICOs, they're not really trying. It's a speculative game, and there's clearly something where fraudsters have actually got to it. The things that concern me are things that could undermine actual trust in the economy. Now, I think the most damaging frauds have been those of the subprime era and particularly the LIBOR era. I think I can make a decent case that the absolute rage of, you know, most of the population at discovering that the interest rate markets have been systematically fixed for 10 years, that was a big element in the development of populist politics. You know, when people write the history of the last sort of 10 years and how we got where we are, Bob Diamond is, and his performance is going to be in there. You know, LIBOR is going to be in there, subprime is going to be in there, because it destroyed people's confidence in a whole kind of swathe of society.
Mm-hmm.
So really, what I'd be worrying about is money from the former Soviet Union, which was itself extracted by means that I would consider fraudulent, making its way structurally into the OECD economy through channels where it looks like various forms of tax fraud and evasion are going on, and which are committing the market crime of money laundering. And the market crime of money laundering is basically a fraud against the government, because it's a fraud which undermines the government's legitimate ability to say that you can only take part in the legitimate economy using money that you've got from legitimate means. So, yeah, that's what would worry me more than anything else. Sales of large, expensively branded real estate in financial and business centers all over the world to people where proper know-your-customer controls have not been carried out, because that's what I think has the ability, potentially, to really undermine trust in the high-trust economies of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there it is.
Right. Sounds like a reasonable concern to me. And you talk about this optimal level of fraud. Is there a way of knowing in a market, in a in an economy, if we're one side of that of that line or the other?
I'm not sure, because I think the optimum level of fraud can potentially be very high, and because the nature of it is that it's only too high when you're doing things that will undermine the trust that you kind of that's the basis of the economy into the long term. And seeing that ex ante, I think, is even more difficult than seeing that something's above all. Now, there were plenty of people, you know, I know some of them from my career, broking to hedge funds all over the world, who saw that US housing was a bubble and who saw that US subprime was a bubble and, you know, made a lot of money out of it. I don't think any of those guys realized that US subprime plus LIBOR plus all the other scandals were going to end up destroying public trust in expert opinion so far that it gave us Brexit and Donald Trump. So, I mean, that would be the level of wisdom that you'd have to have. So, yeah, that's a fairly kind of pessimistic conclusion too. I don't think it's possible. And I don't think it's possible because I think you can have societies like Victorian London or kind of Gold Rush United States, or Railway Mania United States, even better example, where an incredibly high level of corruption exists with an incredibly high level of trust and productive activity.
I suppose one of the key questions is whether or not you can have some of these things and it doesn't create, you know, take the whole system down with it. You know, if, as you say, with the, you know, the Bitcoin ICO thing, is sure, if people want to, you know, take a punt on this stuff, as long as it doesn't take the system down, then, you know, fill through your boots.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, mainstream marketing of Bitcoin and ICO products to retail investors, that would worry me a lot. At the moment, I kind of feel like everyone involved in it either knows or ought to know that they're getting into something where, you know, they're trying to hope to pass it on to a greater fool. Moving that into kind of what you'd call actual investors, yeah, that would concern me a lot.
Are there any kind of personal rules of thumb that you use when you're making these your own, whether it's investment decisions or big decisions?
Well, my bias is the other way, Ben. So, the rules of thumb that I use are always to try and talk myself out of being too cynical.
Right. Okay.
So you know, all the time, you know, kind of if I look at technology or stocks or kind of investments of that sort, I'm always thinking about Theranos and you had that scam and this thing turned out to be a scam. And so my rules of thumb are that I'm always trying to remember, you know, Steve Jobs faked demos too, didn't mean he was a bad guy. Larry Ellison faked some of the most important demos in the history of Oracle, didn't mean it was a bad thing. So yeah, in many ways, actually, probably the rule of thumb is that someone put it to me the other day, there is a big book about the entire history of all asset returns since the beginning of capitalism, and there is a reason that the title of that book is Triumph of the Optimists. You know, if you're, and diversification helps, obviously, if you're in a position where no one investment can hurt you too badly, then you can afford to be a bit more trusting. And in general, over the course of history, being a bit more trusting has actually been the optimal strategy.
That's those are wise words, and those are very good rules of thumb. It's probably a great place to wrap things up. But before we do, well, first of all, was there anything that you wanted to mention about the book? And we'll obviously give you a chance to let my listeners know where they can find it. But was there anything that we didn't get a chance to speak about?
Well, just really, actually, with respect to the book, if your North American listeners will not be able to buy it yet. It's marked up as unavailable on Amazon there. The reason for that is that we have sold the US rights to Scribner Books, and I am currently writing a expanded US edition. Basically because the UK version has things like payment protection insurance.
Yeah.
It's got value-added tax in there. It's got references to the Cray twins, who, despite the best efforts of Guy Ritchie, no one in America cares about. And so I'm kind of taking those bits out and replacing them with more US relevant material. I've also been told by my US editor that North Americans in general have stronger forearms than Europeans, so they object less to big, thick, heavy hardbacks. So the US edition is going to be about 10-20% longer.
Right.
And that's coming out sometime in 2019, presuming I finished writing it by the deadline.
Perfect. Well, that sounds very, very exciting and a very prescient book. And it's a wonderful read. I love the stories. It's interspersed with some these colorful stories, but also, you know, a good level of explanation. And you don't need to be, you know, an economist or a financier to understand it. So, congratulations on it. Very well put together piece of work.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much, Ben.
Before we finish off, for my listeners that just want to follow you, I know you're active on Twitter. Where can they connect with you and the like?
Currently, on Twitter, I am at D Squared Digest. If anyone is interested in credit risk outsourcing, then we have a very solid counterparty credit risk outsourcing product at Frontline Analysts, which is one of my day jobs. Mm-hmm. Other than that, that takes up the majority of my time.
Thank you. Dan, this was great. I really appreciate you joining me. It was, I really enjoyed this.
Really interesting questions. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. And best of luck with the book, and particularly the American edition. And, you know, we'll certainly stay connected here. And, once again, thanks. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thanks so much. Take care.
All right, I hope you found that as fascinating as I did. Check out Lying for Money, check out Dan. All the links are in the show notes as usual. And let me know what you think. Let me know what you think of this episode or of the show in general, allthingsrisk@gmail.com. Let me know your thoughts on Twitter about fraud or anything related to that. @riskthings is my Twitter handle. And if you haven't yet subscribed to the show, go to allthingsrisk.co.uk and you can find all the ways in which you can get All Things Risk, our podcast, into your earbuds via the podcast app of your choice. We will be back in a couple of weeks with another great episode. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.